And so we're ready to go. And for Drew and Melissa, sorry, I think the last 10 minutes of what I was talking about got cut off, which was related sort of to wetland mapping assignment. So if you're completely confused, call me. We are now looking at the wetlands mapper webpage or website, which is wetlandsfws.er.usgs.gov. And if you, when you bring that up, you'll see it says wetlands digital data and mapping, and it says go to the wetlands mapper homepage, and that's what we want to do. And you click on that. Oh, incidentally, just before that, wetlands status and trends, that's where the new, and right to the left here, you can click on that new report, all 100 and some pages of it, if you're interested in looking at that. Or you can just read the executive summary that I handed out. Okay. all right, so here we are. This is the wetlands mapper. And so make sure that you kind of pay attention and take notes here, because you can use this again for creating your vicinity map, which is the first number in your, the first requirement in your wetland mapping assignment. And I know that's redundant to you. I've said it now 5 times, but since these guys may not have heard me, I'm just gonna say it again. Here it is, right here. Okay. So we're going to click on go to wetlands mapper. And all right. When you do that, you have this new window that comes up, and it says, here's a tutorial. So if you want to read over the tutorial, you can, and there might even be a help menu there, but this is so intuitive that if you've worked with computers, you won't have any problems at all. All you want to do is go down to where it says select region you wish to view, okay? And you want to basically just click on, let's do East Tennessee. And it should zoom in. And we're waiting. Are y'all doing that too? We might overload the system, I have no idea. Are you ahead of me? Okay. So just keep zooming in. If you want to zoom into a different part of the country, Nebraska or Pennsylvania or someplace, you can. All right, let's go ahead and take a look at, let's see here, where should we take a look at? Why don't we do Seven Islands? Seven Islands is right about here. It is down I-40, and you exit right about here. 402 exit going east on I-40. Knox County Park is Seven Islands Wildlife Refuge. And that looks like the bend, doesn't it, right there? Okay. So we can zoom in a little closer and see what they have. They don't have, I did look at this one earlier, they don't have the new wetland. Okay, so this is Seven Islands Wildlife Refuge, basically this area right in here. And here is a wetland right here. That's actually, that should be the pond right there. Now, you can see the codes that they have here. That's the first thing I want to point out to you. So you have, this is the French Broad River that comes around this point. It's listed as R2, which is riverine, and there, their code goes along with the one that I handed out to y'all. That is the National Wetlands Inventory Code, not the one that I made separately. So two should be, I'm assuming that's riverine, And for their number two, it is lower perennial. Okay? So lower perennial, UB unconsolidated bottom, and let's see, three is mud. And remember that after the subclass, which is mud, I asked you all to put a hyphen or a forward slash. And you won't see that on these National Wetland Inventory maps. H is actually the modifier for a water modifier, and that H is permanent. Let's see, I believe. Water modifiers. Yeah, H is permanently flooded. So make that distinction with your maps. Okay, and then apparently over here there is some cluster and forested wetlands here that are on these islands that they've classified. And then they actually, for some reason, right at this point, ironically, at Seven Islands, you can see this different shading that's going on. They are now calling that lacustrine. They consider that, the beginning of when Lake Loudoun starts, way up there. It's interesting because if you look at the Nolichucky side, it's almost where it forms the Tennessee River. It's not far from Knoxville. But this is up much farther, and I have no idea why they...
It does get a lot deeper.
Does it get a lot deeper, just basically right there at those... Okay, so maybe they have some information there. I don't know. All right, so there... Now, what information can we get here? Let's go ahead and zoom in right on this little wetland, which is a pond. Okay, you can see palustrine, unconsolidated bottom, and it is permanently flooded. Now, I'll tell you right now, from being out there, there's more than just one class. There's more than one class. They don't even have a subclass there, do they? Because it's UB, then they just go to H, it's permanently flooded. So that's why I'm kind of talking about that these are kind of good to almost find where wetlands are, to get some information on them, and kind of get maybe some information on total acres. But as far as detailed information on classes and subclasses, you need to get out there and ground truth. But that's about as best as they can get from aerial imagery. Okay. So what information can we get here? Now let's just kind of go through here. Let me grab a handout a note thing that I had, and make sure we hit all the things I was interested in hitting. And what did I do with that? There are some notes there. But that was related to something else. That's it, right there. Thanks. All right, so the first thing we want to do is, okay, when you start here, let's just go across these icons. Okay, I kind of just jumped right in, but you're automatically on the zoom, okay, the little hour magnifying glass. And obviously there is zoom out if you want to go back out. If you click this one, that'll zoom to the very beginning of the United States. Okay, that's zoom full extent going to the right, going from left to right. This is zoom to the extent of the map before. So if we click this, this will just go to exactly the previous map that we had, which was there. Okay, again, the hand moves it around just like it typically does. Now, this eye is very similar. If you've done any work with ArcMap, I mean, these are very similar icons. Eye is identify. Okay, it gives you features about a certain wetland class that you have interest in. So I'm going to re-zoom in here so we can take a look here at that. Okay, now let's go ahead and click the identify button. And the identify button when we click on that polygon for the seven islands, it'll come up with some information on it. And basically what it will tell you is the wetland type and its acreage. And it'll give you also the coordinates for the center of that polygon. And that is good information for when you report, when you put it in your report, oops, my microphone fell off, that you put in your report, the coordinates should include the lat-long coordinates. And again, this is one way to get those lat-long coordinates if your wetland is in this database. And this is taking a while here. You will also notice just at the bottom left here that there are coordinates on the bottom. Those are in decimal degrees. Okay, so 83.69 and 35.95. So you could just with your cursor point to basically the center of your wetland and get and write down those coordinates to include in your report. And is it working for y'all? Are you all on this?
Yeah.
Did it come up yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you didn't. Okay. Well, what does it seem to be?
It's hard to read.
Huh. John, you want to take a look? Well, that's what the identify button does, if it would download here. I am, hopefully, I'd like to just stop this. No, I don't. Well, hell, I may. I don't think I did, yeah. Okay. So. Damn it. We are just sitting here for those at home waiting for this thing to download, and I'm wondering if it's too many of us trying to log on at the same time. Do you think you could handle it? But okay. Do something. I don't know. Okay. Good. There we go. All right. Well, let's just do some other things. So that's what it does. Write that down in your notes. Okay. Now, you have, we'll come back to this little eraser thing, but that basically will erase any graphics that you add to this map. Okay, so you can actually put text, boxes, etc. So again, you can use this for making your vicinity map. This one here is to extract the data as a shapefile. So when you click on that, if you want to import this stuff into ArcGIS, you can. It'll export it, and on the right side, it will, when it's ready to go, It'll actually zip it up into a file, and you can then download that to your computer and then bring it into ArcGIS. It will only do the wetland coverages. It won't put on the roads and all that stuff. Okay? It won't have the roads in there. You can only, the only way you can have that information is if you actually create your map within here, within Wetlands Mapper. Now, I'm clicking Advanced Tools, and I'm just going to get again go through and point at stuff, and then we'll do a few things to show you its capabilities. The eye here is with, it looks like several book stack. Actually will give you, if you click on that, it'll give you all the information for all the features that are within the view. The identify with a circle is if you want everything identified within a certain radius. Let's see here. Now, here's where you can add different information. First of all, these are the user-defined features that you can add. The first one is if you want to put a point on your map. So let me click that and see what happens. Hopefully it'll do something here. If it doesn't, then I'm just going to have to explain things to you. And you guys, I mean, you can literally go home and work on this and mess around and learn all the capabilities relatively quickly. It's not rocket science by any means. You just mess around first to figure out its functions. But it does look like it's doing something.
Did you have problems with using
Well, no, that was the other thing we're going to show you. Yeah, so I'm showing you Wetlands Mapper today. Then John and I will show you how to download DOQQs from tngs.org and actually how to bring those in and create maps. In fact, this has the DOQQs. You can actually overlay those on here. And this is, you know, one of the problems of trying to do this here with a in-class exercise because things aren't that fast. So I'm just going to go through as this thing's attempting to do something and tell you what the rest of these things do. Again, this creates a point, and what it'll do is it'll just create a star and you can put a label on it. So you can click it anywhere on this map if you want to identify something like, you know, gate. If you want to say there's a gate here, this is how you enter, whatever. The next one is a line. Again, if you want to create a line that showed maybe a trail that isn't shown on here, and you could just create a line and then have a label for that line. The same thing, here's a rectangle. Here is just a polygon, so you know, multiple-sided shape. The next is text, if you want to put some text in here. Let's see. Okay, this is a user-defined grid, the one that has the, looks like a tic-tac-toe icon. I don't recommend that. It'll create a grid on here, but it's a generic grid. It's not a geo-reference grid. By default, when you create a map, a PDF of this in here, it will put the coordinates on there. It'll put a grid system on, and I can't believe this thing's still trying to download. It'll put a grid system down automatically. Now, if you want to add, XY is to add specific coordinates. So if you wanted to just, for a particular point, click on it, it will put the coordinates for right where you click on this map. Okay? And then finally, if you want to remove any of the stuff that you put down here, this last arrow says erase selected markup. You can click on a specific thing that you've added to delete it, or if you click the eraser bar over again to the far left, that'll remove everything on the map. All right. I do not know what else is going on. Okay, so let's just go ahead and do something else since this is not cooperating. Don't use the add grid to map, because that's a user-defined grid. And it'll just be basically A's, it'll say, it'll go across like A's on the top, A's through letters on the top and numbers on the bottom, and it doesn't mean anything. I guess that's, you know, helpful if you're saying it, you know, if you want to break it up into a grid and say in zone A1. It is kind of like an atlas, exactly, but it will not be a geo-referenced grid, which is really kind of nice to have when you're creating a vicinity map. But what other options do you have here? Okay, what I want to show you all is, what I did is I clicked on layers. And layers has all the layers that are selected and not selected. This is the, within the wetlands one here, what I recommend, now write this stuff down, you won't remember this probably. Wetlands data availability, you want to click off of that one. Okay, well at least this interacts pretty quickly. Let me show you what that did. Let me click back on it. And all it did, see it put the word digital on there? Well, you don't want that word on there. That's all it really does. It shows you where an area is mapped and it isn't mapped. So if you're in East Tennessee, most everything has been mapped. If it isn't, then it's not there. Okay, but it will show you actually in wetlands map, or if there's a zone where none of it's been digitally mapped, okay? By just clicking off of that, you still have your wetlands layer here, but you don't have that word digital. The other thing I don't like is Tennessee. Well, okay, we know we're in Tennessee. We don't need that right in the middle of our map. Or you can have that, you know, in the legend or something, some other text off to the side, if you want to indicate that. So to remove that, we need to come underneath of base data. And underneath of base data, you will see a variety of things here. Cities, zip codes, if you wanted the zip code put on here. Here is USGS Quad. I kind of recommend you click off that. That's the Boyd's Creek. That's what Boyd's Creek is. That's the USGS Quad. You click off of that and it gets rid of it. And then if we want Tennessee off of it, then click off of states, 100K. And that'll take Tennessee off of it. Okay, now what we have here is we have something that's clear, we have some roads. If we were at a county boundary, it would have, you could see that. So one thing that might be nice is if, again, with this user-defined text up here, you can put the county in just by finding out what county it's in and just indicate that directly yourself, unless if you're near a county, again, a county border, it'll show you the border on both sides with labels. But it doesn't show the county, unfortunately. I wish there was something to click on to do that, but it doesn't appear to be. It has all your roads, major roads. The ones that are gray you can't click off of, okay? Only the ones that are clear. Streams are all there. Let's see, what else can we add? I think that all looks good. Okay, so now you're dealing with a pretty nice area here, area map. Again, for a vicinity map, you want to back off of it some so you can show folks how to get there. And, you know, just for example, you probably want to have it at about this level. Okay, so you can see your map, your wetland here, and you could use some, you may want to zoom in a little bit more just to show the road names, but, so let's go ahead and do that. Zoom in one more time. Let's just zoom in to just about like that, see what it does. See if it gives us the road names. It'd be nice to have road names in there. Okay. Now, what else can you do? underneath of V, or excuse me, WMS. If you click on the folder, it will show you other imagery that you can load, which is pretty cool stuff. Okay, you, right here, you can download DRGs, digital raster graphics, are topos, they're georeferenced. And if you click on that, it'll automatically put a topo on top of your image. There you go. Pretty sweet, huh? Now that's pretty neat. You can really kind of see things. It still has your labels in there. Again, you might put some additional labels to help clarify things. You can see the roads. That shows all the forested areas, shows your contours, etc. That's pretty cool stuff. Again, I'll show you also kind of just if you just want a topo of your area, which is again what we used for our vicinity map, you can do that in topozone.com and just by using in Microsoft PowerPoint. You don't even need to use this. But I'm going to show you what's also really cool about this is that, okay, you have that. Let's go ahead and click off. Now, the other image it can show is the DOQQ, so let's click on that one. This will be a geo-referenced aerial image. So, okay. So if you like that view, which is, again, an aerial photo, and again, it doesn't project great, but it still has, you can see your different wetland zones, etc. It just gives you an aerial photo. All right. Now, next Thursday, John will just show you how to bring DOQQ into ArcGIS because it is important to actually have a DOQQ and zoom in on an area very close. Now, this may be good. This might be the image you want to use for your vicinity map. I'm showing you vicinity map techniques. If we wanted something that was a little more useful for us in the field when we are actually physically mapping, then we would zoom in big time. So we just see I must have zoomed in too close. I guess I zoomed in. So you would just see the wetland, okay? And you can use that, and you can actually take that map into the field when you're mapping your wetland to write things on it and to show where different areas are, and then you come back and actually do heads-up digitizing in ArcGIS to actually create maps, more specific maps than this. And again, we're going to go over that next Thursday. Now, what do I suggest? It is up to you whether you want, you know, this image, an image like this, whether you want a topo using the DRGs, whether you want to do a topo separate or what have you. But it needs to include all the information that your vicinity map that is required in the ENG 4345 form. Okay? Now, let's go ahead and I am just going to click off the DOQQ. All right, and now let's say we want a map. Okay, so let's go ahead and right here. If we're done with our map, there are two things. You can save a project over here. It says save project. And you can open a project later on. So you can begin work on this and come back, etc. You can email it to somebody if you want, to your partner. Okay. Here's the extract the shape file. Now, to print and create a PDF of what you're looking at, you can create a map title here. All I did was click print PDF, y'all. And here's the current scale. If you want to change the scale, you can. I just keep the current scale. And the title of your map, let's say Seven Islands wetland. And down here in the map notes, you can actually provide lots of details. You can provide details on entire directions if you want. This will allow you to put a lot of darn text in there. And what I probably would recommend is for a vicinity map are simple directions such as to get to the wetland, take I-40 to exit 402. Exit right, take X road, turn right, blah, blah, blah. And it gets you to the refuge, and then you indicate how you get to that wetland. I'll just say go to exit 402 on I-40, okay, just so you can see where that is. Now let's go ahead and click OK, and it'll create the PDF. Now, you can open the map here. Of course, you need Adobe Reader, which usually you have. The map that's created is pretty professional. It's pretty cool. All right, this is it. All right, and here's your grid system I'm talking about. Now, if you made your user-defined grid system, y'all, it would be over top of this, and it just gets very cluttered. Shows where you're located in the United States. It has your legend already created right here. It has the scale right here on the bottom right. It has your north arrow. It has the center of the map coordinates. So one thing you really kind of want to do is make sure that your wetland is positioned towards the center. And again, if you just want to enter those coordinates directly for the wetland, you can, again, get those off of when you're interacting with a wetlands mapper, just by pointing your cursor on it, or, again, doing that XY coordinate thing where you enter it. Down here, there's your title up at the top. And at the bottom, you can see you have a large box where you can put lots of directions to basically get to that area. Again, this is a vicinity map to show people how to get there. Yes, Nathan.
Is there any way you can think about half that trash like
yes, you can, by deselecting it. So the question was, how can you get this trash off of the right side? By deselecting it in Wetlands Mapper. Before we do that, let me just say, if you've worked with PDFs, you can just come over here and hit Save Copy As, and you can save it right to your hard drive so that you have that PDF copy on your hard drive, okay? So, yeah, what about that? If we wanted to, again, it's underneath of layers. If we don't want all that stuff, we can deselect those things like cities. You're not looking at any cities here anyways. And just keep deselecting. Whatever is selected here is going to show up in your legend. So we could literally, forget the counties. We probably want our roads. Interstate isn't there. Streams, well, the streams are minor streams. So you see like this little creek here? So if we don't really care about that, take that off. All right, see, it's gone. Urban areas. What's that?
Go all the way up to the top.
Top left of the screen.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Oh, it shows you what you got here.
Okay. Yeah, that's north of South America.
Yeah, where'd you see that?
Yeah, top right. Of the map legend.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that's it. There you go. Hey, excellent. So that's a good one, y'all. So there you can deselect. I didn't even know you could do that. And then you can hit apply settings. So, yeah, North and South America, states. We can take all that junk off. Yeah. Counties. Yeah. Streams. Water bodies. Okay. So let's just see what happened when we did that apply settings. Yeah, when the next time you refresh. Okay, so anyways. Okay. So that's did y'all see where we did that? We went to legend right here, and then we went to settings, and we just removed here we go. See, now you don't see those now. Okay. All right, so you can reduce that junk. Is that clear, y'all? Pretty clear? Is it constant? Yeah, so you'll have more white space. But at least there won't be things on there that don't mean anything. Zero and one won't be on. Yeah, for example. Okay. I apologize for actually why these little things aren't working here, but it's real simple. It's just like working in Microsoft PowerPoint. You can just add different things here, labels, etc. But that is a pretty easy way to make a vicinity map, and and it's pretty professional. Now, any questions with that? Okay, so we went through all that stuff, how to create a PDF. Again, that identifier button to give you information on wetland size or the coordinates. Again, you can see how I'm just pointing on it. I can get the coordinates right there down the bottom left. We went through points, lines, rectangles. User-defined grid, don't use. That eraser bar, if you add stuff again and you want to remove things, you have your eraser bar up here. It removes it all. Right here, this last pencil on the far right is just if you want to erase just certain items that you can select on specifically. And again, you can add the DRGs or the DOQQs if you're so interested. And as I mentioned, you want to deselect underneath of layers, you want to deselect the wetlands data availability, because that just has the thing that says digital on there. You want to deselect the state and the quad as well. That information is generally not that important. It's right always in the damn middle of your map, and if you position your wetland in the middle, then it screws things up. Things start to get overlapped on top of each other. Okay, I guess that is pretty much sums that little tutorial up. Is that pretty good? I hope that wasn't too much of a disaster. So hopefully everybody's computer savvy in here. At least within a group, hopefully there's one computer savvy person if you don't feel that confident, and you guys can kind of work through things together and even divvy tasks up if you don't want to tackle this one yourself, somebody else in your group could. Okay, so I'm going to close out of that. Again, that is a really neat, and it's just all those capabilities have been updated lately. All right, and as I did mention, you can export the wetland shape file if you wanted to, so that you can bring it into ArcGIS. Back here at the presentation then, let's see, where are we? Okay, that is basically Wetlands Mapper. I would like to go through a few more slides, y'all. And so the next slide, we're really kind of starting to, you know, talk about mapping. There's your vicinity map. Now let's talk about what are we going to do with respect to, let's see, is this thing still going? No, it isn't. What are we going to do with respect to mapping our wetlands? How are we going to do it? Well, the first thing that you're going to do, and we're going to teach you next Thursday, is to get a map that you can take out into the field so that you can hand sketch where your different classes and subclasses are located. What you want to end up with is a map similar to this one in the end that you see here. And this is actually not even done in ArcGIS. And we'll show you how to do that, but you can at least, with this handout, you can see how each of the classes and subclasses are indicated. You want it to that level of detail. Okay? So So the first thing is we can create a field map using ArcGIS.org and DOQG. We'll show you that next time. Then what you have to do, you got to go out and ground truth. Now, you can ground truth two different ways. You can check out a GPS unit from John, and you can walk around each of the wetland subclasses, okay? And then download that into ArcGIS. If you are savvy with a GPS unit, go ahead and do it. If you're not, don't do it. Because John's not going to take hours upon hours to teach you how to do all of that stuff. He'll show you how to turn the GPS unit on and basically download. But to geocorrect points and to get it all imported, that does take a level of understanding that you really need to have already. Unless you can maybe go do it for a 12-pack beer or something like that. I'm not going to tell him how much he helps with. That's up to him. But what I would prefer that you do is, and it's perfectly fine, is to actually do number three, which is with your map in hand and using your using a map, a compass, and basically measuring distances in the field, map onto your field map the subclasses. Then bring those back into the lab with your DOQQ and just do heads-up digitizing, creating different layers for different subclasses. And John's going to show you how to do that next week. All right? So I would recommend doing number three here. Again, if you want to do the GPS stuff, you're welcome to. We have some nice GPS units that you can check out. Is that clear? I don't mean to discourage you. If you want to learn that, then chat with John and we'll see what we can do for you. It really probably is, and I'm making it more difficult than it really is. But there are quite a few steps basically to go from using the unit to downloading the information to geocorrecting those coordinates because there'll be error in it from the satellites. To then get those into ArcGIS to then have a map when you can kind of just do heads up digitizing and field recurrence. So. Now, when you're doing field reconnaissance, like you can see we're doing here in Puerto Rico, you are out there and yes, you are ocularly estimating where these areas are based on your interpretation of your map you've created. And you're measuring distances out. So you need to know where you're located in the wetland. You can pace off directions, pace off your distances, or you can measure them directly. And then as far as determining what subclass they could be, you're doing that by ocular estimation based on the relative horizontal vegetative cover that exists. Okay, now I know that's a big kind of vague thing. How do I do that, right? Okay, and that's what we're going to go through. So that's the next step here. This is what John is going to get you to. This is a DOQQ image of a farm pod on the West Tennessee, Plateau Research and Education Center. Okay? And that's about as clear as it's going to get. We're zoomed in on it. And that's what you're going to go into the field with. Well, this you can see. This is what this and some other imagery that they're using. You're using some infrared imagery as well to classify wetlands. You can't see a whole lot. Now I know what happens to be at this wetland because I've been there. But it's this wetland zone actually runs very close to this edge. There's a forested band here. And then there's a nice drainage that comes up, the wetland portion comes up into this area. But this is what you want to go into the field with, and then from there sketch out the details. And it's amazing how much information you can actually translate from being on the ground and looking at things and actually looking at this image. Okay, so the first thing that you'll want to do, and we can do this right in, John will show you how to go from the DOQQ image to a layout form in ArcGIS. And the first thing you want to do is divide your wetland into quadrants.
okay? So you'll divide the wetland into quadrants, into the cardinal quadrants. Now, from there, what you want to do, the first exercise, is to delineate the wetland. So there are really two components to this wetland mapping exercise. Again, Corps of Engineers delineation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service mapping. Okay, now how are you going to determine whether or not the Corps of Engineers conditions are met for it to be a wetland site? Okay, well, what you're going to do is you're going to establish transects in each one of these quadrants. I recommend that you establish at least one transect per quadrant. Okay, one transect per quadrant. Where do you establish your transect? So what we're talking about doing is establishing a transect here. We want it to traverse the elevational contour going from deep to the upland. And we want to do it in some type of statistically valid way. For you guys that have taken stats, what would you think would be logical? Or if you haven't taken stats, what would seem logical? Where could we place that transect? Can you just go up there and look and place it? We don't want to do that. We want to do it either, we want to do it in some standardized format. One way is random sampling, right? And the other is systematic. Okay, now what I recommend y'all do is that you just systematically place it. It's easier to do in the field. And the systematic placement that I recommend is the midpoint distance between this, if we're looking at the northeast quadrant here, the midpoint distance running along the shoreline, okay, going up your wetland here, and the north aspect. So you have to first pace your shoreline, or the edge of your wetland, excuse me, and then determine that distance and then pace back half the distance. At that point, then I would run a contour, I would run a transect, excuse me, perpendicular to the contour. So that approximate distance, and you can eyeball pretty good even on, well, we'll show you that you can actually measure the distance right here in ArcGIS before you even get out there. And you can measure that using the distance ruler tool and figure out the halfway point and then measure up and actually even draw, okay, I'm going to put my transect right there and go out there, and that's going to be where you put your transect. All right? All right. Now, correspondingly, you do one for each of the other quadrants. Now, you could put more if you have some weird variation that you want to pick up, but I recommend at least one per quadrant. And what is the goal here? The goal is to determine the edge of the wetland. The edge of the wetland, where it becomes upland. All right? So I recommend that basically your transect run from all the way from the upland, where you know that it's definitely upland, it doesn't have wetland characteristics, down through the wetland until you hit permanent water. If your wetland does not have permanent water, then I recommend that you run it all the way until it hits the azimuth of the next quadrant. Okay? So, the transect molar edge, you go to the permanent water or the cardinal azimuth. Okay? Here we have permanent water, so we stop. The question when you delineate wetlands is not where the deep water zone is or whatever. That's a wetland classification question. And what type of wetland that this permanently flooded zone is. Again, we want to catch the gradient of change along this transect and when it becomes the upland, and that's where the edge is. Once we know where the edge is, then we, with field observations, based on this transect, we basically just follow that contour, okay? Now, that could be a long distance, and hence the reason that you may want to have more than one transect. If you start to feel uncomfortable about where the edge of the wetland is, okay? But at least four or at least one per quadrant. Okay, is that clear? Now, what do you do along this transect? Well, we're going to collect information. And let's see. Okay. As I mentioned, yeah, the upper end goes up into the upper. Okay. Along each of these transects, you're going to establish plots. And the plots that you are going to establish depend on, the plots that you're going to establish depend on the type of vegetation that is present. If you are sampling a herbaceous wetland, I recommend that you place your plots 5 meters apart. Okay? If it's a herbaceous wetland. If you're in a shrub wetland, I recommend 10 meters apart on that transect. And if you're in a forested wetland, 20 meters apart. The reason for these will become more apparent in a second, and it has to do with the relative plot size that you're going to use to assess dominance of plants for each of these categories of vegetation. Okay? Remember, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers criteria is herbaceous and vine. We'll go over that in a second. Shrub and forest areas. All right. They can be closer. You can place these closer, and it's necessary, especially if you have a very quick gradient. If you're in a forested area right here, for example, which is forested, by the way, if this is forested, if you go 20 meters here from the water, okay, you may be out of your zone. So the recommendation that I recommend in that case is that you take the midpoint distance if it is less than any one of these categories. The midpoint distance of the zone of this vegetation. Okay? Now, okay, questions? The placement of the first plot should begin, this isn't on here, should begin if you have a permanent water zone. Okay? Well, let me just say it both ways. Whether you have a permanent water zone or you go all the way to the azimuth, I recommend that you, at that point, you back in, you go back up the gradient 10 meters, and then you start the placement of your plots, okay? And following these separations. If it's the permanent water, then that where that transect ends, then it's 10 meters from it. If it's too far, if you've obviously moved out of the wetland, again, this means we're not classifying. If you have moved completely out of the wetland in 10 meters, then my recommendation is that you come back to the midpoint distance, which would be 5 meters between the edge of the water or the azimuth. Is that clear? Okay. Then again, from there, I would recommend following the spacing.
There's not established vegetation, and you're still on 5 meters or less than that.
If there's not established vegetation, if you're in a permanently flooded zone, then you do not need to run out your transect out there. Well, again, let me just back up. Again, we're going up into the upland here.
Yeah.
So basically, if it's dry, you run the transect to the azimuth. okay? If it's if it's permanently flooded, then you stop the water. Okay? I guess that's the rule. Now what's unclear?
I was just asking, like, I mean, you know, just, you know, I don't know what the truth is.
Okay. If it's herbaceous, yeah. Then, you know, whether, you know, whether they're non-persistent or they're persistent, yeah. If it's aquatic, well, then you've hit the water, so you stop. You know, is that a little bit clear?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to. Okay. Should be 10 meters from either the water, the permanently flooded zone, or the azimuth, the cardinal azimuth that it would intersect if you traversed all the way into the well. If it happens to be, like in this case here, if you happen to move 10 meters from there and you're out of the wetland, obviously, already, then you go half the distance. Yeah, after 5 meters. Okay, and if you're there, okay, at 5 meters, then the next plot that you place is going to be up in the upland. So you've basically found the wetland's edge. If you're not at the edge of the wetland, so you're finding characteristics of a wetland, then you keep moving up the gradient, following this spacing depending on the type of vegetation, herbaceous, shrub, or forest. Okay? Now, is that clear? Once you've found that edge and you get a good feeling around your wetland where that is based on the contours, okay? Again, you're either mapping this physically or you're walking with a GPS unit. Then you want to talk about really how to measure the vegetation within these plots. And that'll be for two questions. One is to establish dominance and whether the wetland meets the hydrophyte criteria. And the second is then in the classification. There's going to be two different approaches. Now, what about for you all that are doing linear wetlands? Okay, this is a pond. What if you're going to do a riverine wetland, for example, or you have a massive lake or a reservoir or something like that that you would like to map? For this assignment, I am asking you all to at least map 300 meters. Go along for 300 meters of shoreline. And within there, space your transects, 4 transects every 50 meters. So if you're going to map 300 meters, then space, come in from those edges and put your transects equidistant at about 50 meters. At least 50 meters, I guess it could be a little bit more than that. Well, you'd have 25 meters on each side, wouldn't you? Let's see, 4. Now, 4 is 200, so you have 50 meters on each side. So you have 50 meter buffers, and then you have 2 transects coming in, one at 150 and at 100. So, is that clear? You did a linear wetland. Do I need to write that on the board? Or is that clear? Raise your hand if you're unclear. I mean, it, seriously, because this is important stuff to understand, though. Okay, so. All right, so let's say we have a creek that we're doing, riverine wetland. All right, go ahead and map 300 meters of it. All right, then come in 50 meters and put a transect. 50 meters and put a transect, then another 50 meters and another 50 meters. Okay? That's only 250, right? So you'll have 100. All right, well then do 5. You do the one. for at least 5 turns. You're probably going to have to do more than 4, you know, for most pond type wetlands too. Okay. Is that clear? All right. Now, the next thing is, here's your transect here. How are we going to, this is for wetland delineation along these transects. How are we going to determine if it meets the hydrophyte criteria? Well, we're going to use the 50-20 dominance rule like we learned the first day. All right, so there's your transect, an example of it. And right in the center is placement of a plot. Okay, for the herb layer, we are going to measure that in a 1 meter square frame. You can check out frames from John. Okay? Remember that herb for the Corps of Engineers means all herbaceous vegetation, and it means woody plants less than 1 meter in height. Okay? So make sure you're clear about that. All right, we're going to measure percent horizontal cover in this 1 meter square frame, y'all. So, again, you have a 1 meter square frame, you're going to estimate percent horizontal cover for the herbaceous layer. If there's no herbaceous layer, then there's no information to collect. You look at the other layers. And if there are more than one layer, remember, you're looking at all the strata. Okay, number two. The shrub layer, we're going to measure in a 100-meter square plot. Okay, so we're going out 5 meters on each side so that we have a 10 by 10-meter plot. I'm drawing square plots. On the next slide, I'll show you what the radius would be if you do a circular plot, which you may want to do. Sometimes those are a little bit easier. So 5 by 5 meters, or excuse me, 10 by 10 meters. 5 meters. Okay, so shrub as for the Corps of Engineers means woody vegetation that is over a meter in height, but it is less than 3 inches DBH. Again, that's what we went over the first day. All right. For shrubs, we are going to do density, not percent horizontal cover. We're actually going to count the number of shrubs in that 100-meter square plot. The tree layer we're going to do in a 400-meter square plot. Okay? Notice how these are all nested around your sampling location. Okay? For trees, for the core, that means all woody vegetation that's over 3 inches DBH. So you're going to need a couple things here. You're going to need, obviously, a measuring tape. You're going to need a 1 meter square frame, or you can just use a measuring tape. You're going to need a DBH tape. John can check those out for you. The other thing you'll need will be a clinometer, but that'll be for classification, not for delineation. Because the difference between shrubs and trees for wetland classification is based on height, not DBH. Right. We're going to do density. That's going to be our measure of dominance here for the trees. Okay. Now the last one that you could come across, but is very uncommon, is vines, a woody vine layer. And the way that the Corps defines woody vines are woody vines that are greater than a meter in height. Okay. I can't really think of too many cases when that's going to happen. If there's vines that are shorter than a meter in height, then they're in the herbaceous layer. Anything that's even woody, again, woody less than a meter in height is herbaceous layer. That's vertical. Yeah, they come straight up. That would be if really climbing vines, and you're just dominating a climbing vine system, I guess. and you would measure the vines within a 40 meter square plot or a plot that has a 3.67 meter radius. So we're going to do density here. Now, as we talked about before, is that it's certainly possible that you, especially in a shrub layer, or if you got maybe in a wood vine layer, a really thick area, it's really impossible to count everything. And it's the reason why in the herbaceous layer that you don't count every single step. You just do percent horizontal cover. If this is the case for your wetland, then just use percent horizontal cover, recognizing that your accuracy of doing percent horizontal cover decreases dramatically as plot size increases. But if you're dealing with that dense of a situation, you're probably looking and going, it's 100% or 95% or something like that, okay? Otherwise, do density, because that is a better estimate for dominance, okay? Clear? Why is this all important? Why is it important? To determine dominance. Remember, in order to determine dominance, you have to determine it for each of these layers, for every one of your points that you put out there along the transect. Okay? Where does that information go? Well, here's that Corps of Engineers field handout. Okay? So you can indicate here the stratum, the dominant plants, and its calculate its relative dominance. And again, it's either going to be density or percent horizontal cover, and then you calculate dominance. And remember, it's all the dominant species are, you rank them, you add them up until they go over 50%, and then each individual plant species that is greater than 20% dominance. Okay? And if that's bagged from a couple weeks ago, then go over that portion of the lecture here on the podcast. All right. So we need to know that to see if it meets the hydrophyte criteria. Now, this also works into wetland classification, but wetland classification we're going to do a little bit different. Because within a particular wetland, you may have several subclasses that your four transects don't go through. Okay? They're just going through, and you're trying to determine the edge, where that edge is, and then follow the contour. That's the goal of this. The second is then to classify what's in your wetland. So now we've walked around, and based on our transects that we had through the different cardinal in the different cardinal quadrants, we now have determined the edge of our wetland. Okay? And we've done that based on looking at soil, hydrologic characteristics that were apparent, and by looking at the vegetation using the dominance rule, the 50-20 dominance rule. For soil characteristics, you can check out one of those soil meters, or soil meters, soil cores. And again, you're going to be looking for the different characteristics that we talked about. Particularly modeling is what I'm interested in looking at, because I don't have Munsell charts for that. Or any like sulfitic odor or organics, the organic composition of the soil, etc. Just by really eyeballing it. The other thing that you need to do when you're out there, y'all, again, part of this assignment is video documentation. You want to document all the characteristics on here, but then you want to show it in video and take video segments of it. And if you want to take still pictures, that's fine as well. But as far as requirements for the assignment, you need to take video. Which again, we went over where you can do all that over at the studio, get checked out. If you're unclear, just let me know. Okay, so now what we've done is, now within each of these quadrants, we go and we classify the classes and subclasses. So let's say right here, we have a palustrine forested wetland, PFO 1 being broadleaf deciduous, and it actually goes along this entire zone here. Okay? Again, you've mapped this on your map or you've walked around it with a GPS unit. Now, how are we going to determine that? We do need some evidence. So we still need to establish additional plots for the classification. All right? We're going to do this in about the center of the zone within each quadrant. So if we're within this quadrant here, we want to find the center. And we can do that by establishing two lines that basically cut that portion in half. So from basically southeast to north northwest, cutting it in half, and then the same from basically along the northwest southeast line. So northeast southeast line and southwest northeast line. I don't know if I said that. Well, anyways, you can see the picture. So dividing it, and then at that intersection, that's where you put your plot. Now, what do we do for, well, and then you would do that for the other portions of your zone here, other portions of your subclass zone, to provide evidence that indeed that is the class. Now, how do you determine the class and subclass for the classification system? What's the criteria we're looking for? We're using 50-20 dominance. It's greater than 30%. Yeah. That's all you have to do. So once this is established, everything is percent horizontal cover. So, okay, yeah, we might have another zone up there like persistent emerge up in the top corner. Okay. So, again, what plot size do you use? For herbaceous or substrate classes, you use the 1 meter square plot. Okay? So persistent emergent, non-persistent emergent, any of the other herbaceous subclasses. And you ocularly estimate. Now again, one way of that I mentioned before, of whether it's a 1 meter square frame like you see here, or whether it is a larger plot, you can divide up the plot into quadrants and to help you increase the accuracy of your percent horizontal cover estimate. Okay? And then just basically you can average those quadrants together to get a feel for overall. Horizontal cover. Again, we'll do the same size plots for shrubs, for shrub, and for trees. 100 meters square and 400 meters square. Just like we did before. But the difference, remember, between those two layers is not DBH for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, it's height. So 6 meters in height. So you need a clinometer, or at least be able to visually estimate height. Okay. Again, just establish, from that point, you just establish your plots. If you are doing a circular plot, and the radius is, for the 400 meter square, is 11.3 meters. You might want to write that down, because again, a lot of times it's easier from a center point to walk around in a circle, as opposed to establishing a nice square 20 by 20 meter plot. Okay? So the radius is 11.3 meters. For the 100 meter square plot, it's 5.7 meters. Okay? Is that clear? Any questions?
That's right.
That correct. It is higher.
So it's going to be higher above the ground.
Above the ground. That is correct.
More from not trying to go in force than go in the total length.
So this is looking at what, you know, if you have a bunch of windfalls, you know, it's looking at what is the biological classification. And when you have a bunch of windfalls, it's going to open things up and the herbaceous cover is going to start dominating, or shrub cover, whatever's responding. Yeah, I mean, when you have hurricane damage or high wind damage, it does make things a little weird, but it's above ground. It's above ground. Okay. Again, in these plots, for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service classification, you're ocularly estimating, even going out to the 400-meter square plot, you're taking a look at the canopy, and you're looking to see what is dominant. Okay? And we're going to record those dominant plant species. Again, if you don't know what they are, then collect a leaf or collect a... collect the plant with the seed head, if you can find it, you can bring it on in. Actually, you should be, for each of these plots, you should not only provide video documentation, but you need to collect voucher plants and have those pressed to turn in as well. Okay? So your data sheets, as far as, again, dominance, etc., and abundance, should correspond directly with the plants that we, with the plants that you have pressing in your reporting.
How
do you
find the
dominant? Well, it's whatever is dominant. You just need one. Yeah, that's all. And if you have the same plant species in each of these plots, you don't need to collect one from every single plot. Just collect one representative one, and that'll suffice. Okay? Yeah, so 30% down here at the bottom was the cutoff point. And again, now do you have to do this for every single layer? No, you don't. What do you have to do for Fish and Wildlife Service? Not the most dominant layer, but the tallest layer. So you're going for the tallest layer with the biological classification system. You have to measure all the layers for Corps of Engineers. Is that clear? I mean, maybe I'm just being completely just overly redundant, but I'd rather do that to make sure that you're clear than for you not to be clear. All right? So this is a pretty extensive assignment, hence the reason it's not due until November. But it's going to take probably several trips to get it done, and then time to run out. Okay, so that is basically it there. I mean, I have more slides, but we'll go over those next Thursday before we turn it over to John. Yes, sir.
What kind of timetable are we looking at before, once we let the plants either start going dormant or start dying off?
End of October. So, yeah, you should be done by then. Okay, so outside of the wetland mapping and this and that, the next thing that you'll do, we'll talk about doing, is you need to estimate the acreage of each of your subclasses and subclasses. And there are two different ways of doing that, again with ArcGIS, and then I'll show you an old school way that you can do by just using a map that you know the scale of. And you can do that with your ArcGIS map, the DOTU, the scale line. Okay? Is that good, y'all? I'm sorry if it's late, but I thought that was important to cover all this together than to try to break it between Dr. Roberts' lecture.